The Perils and Rewards of Publishing in the Electronic Age, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with John MacArthur of Harper's Magazine, novelist Doris Betts, Shannon Ravenel of Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and Rachel Davies, director of the Carolina Publishing Institute. I'll talk first with John MacArthur of Harper's Magazine.
But even if our readers, a portion of our readers, object to what we're doing, that's fine. My responsibility is also to anger our readers and to enliven the debate. There's not enough debate in this country. There's not enough intellectual combat. There are not enough people speaking their convictions. I don't know much about Ross Perot, but one of the reasons people like Ross Perot is they're so relieved to hear somebody just say what he thinks without worrying about the consequences.
John MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about the perils and rewards of publishing in the United States today. Later on the program, a roundtable discussion about publishing. You'll hear from novelist Doris Betts, Shannon Ravenel of Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and Rachel Davies of the Carolina Publishing Institute. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center, with partial support from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. John MacArthur is the publisher of Harper's Magazine. He's an industry insider, but he's also among the outspoken critics of publishing in this country today. In his most recent book, for example, entitled Second Front, he describes the press's coverage of the Gulf War as complicitous with the PR aims of the government, resulting in a combination of censorship and propaganda. John MacArthur has similarly strong views of the perils and rewards of publishing on the home front. When he visited the National Humanities Center, I invited him to reflect on the relationship of publishing to the concerns of American education, the lines between journalism and advertising, and the social responsibilities of his work as publisher of Harper's. Here's John MacArthur.
I'd say that my hands are more tied by our lack of, I suppose to some extent my hands are tied by the lack of education in the country. I mean, we only have something like 17 or 18% of the American people graduating from college. Hmm. Now, Harper's Magazine, for example, caters to college graduates, so that already puts us behind the eight ball. We're assuming a certain level of sophistication and education on the part of our readers so that we don't have to spoon feed everything to them.
Is it your job to bring them along, to sort of educate them into the community of standards that you adopt and stand for?
No, because if we did that, we'd lose our core readership, which already knows a lot and which already is very, very well educated and very skeptical, and they would get very tired of the magazine if we started trying to teach,
as it were.
Although I think of the magazine certainly as an educational tool that can be used to educate people, we can't get up in the pulpit and start pretending that we're going to educate the masses.
Mm-hmm. Part of your agenda, Rick, is defining the line between advertising and journalism. Tell me about that.
Well, there's been a blurring in the last few years as magazines have become more desperate for advertising and more driven by profit. And there's this thing called advertorial, which you see everywhere in magazines and newspapers nowadays, which is just fake editorial. It's editorial it's advertising masquerading as editorial. And the reader is expected to believe that they're reading a real editorial section of the magazine.
Well, now, wait a minute. Why can't we call this the sophisticated journalism of the 90s rather than corruption and evil, sin, death, and destruction?
Well, because it's entirely created to please an advertiser. There's no reason to do advertorial. You know, an interview with Giorgio Armani about fashion shows up in the Atlantic magazine.
Well, now, is the case farther gone
Except to please an advertiser.
Sure, but I mean, aren't you saying in effect that the case is that the patient is closer to death than we think, that in order to survive as industry, you publishers in effect find yourself with no way out? You have got to do this. You've got to adopt this as a sort of ploy.
No, I don't believe it, because I think the readers are smarter than the publishers give them credit for, and I've seen in time and time again in media seminars, people saying they don't read advertorials, they skip because they can see right away that
they recognize
phony.
It, yeah.
Now, I hope that's true of a lot of people, a lot of readers, The real problem comes with unlabeled advertorial. Uh-huh. There are magazines like, and there are sections of magazines, let's say Esquire, that are devoted entirely to attracting advertising. They don't run a column on what to drink, for example, except to attract liquor advertisers. They don't think that their readers don't know what to drink, I don't think. The same is true of people who do travel advertorials. They're doing it to attract advertisers. They're not doing it to educate their readers about where they might want to spend their summer vacation.
Okay, so if we all give up reading Esquire and Vanity Fair and the travel sections of our local newspapers, who's going to pay for your publications?
That's a good question. And a big problem, and I'm glad we're back to your original question, which is who's tying my hands? My hands are tied to some extent by the advertising business. And believe it or not, my problems are the same as the problems at the big television networks during the Gulf War, for example. Robert Wright, the head of NBC, told me that advertisers deserted in droves during the Gulf War, even though it was homogenized, sanitized coverage with no body bags.
It was still war.
It was still war, and advertisers ran from it. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't matter how many people were watching. So to some extent, I have the same problem where advertisers flee controversy because they think it hurts their advertising. Harper's is all about controversy. And so I have to convince every single advertiser that my controversial editorial is not going to ruin their prospects of selling their product or their idea or their image.
What do you mean by marketing terrorism?
Well, I invented...
Without necessarily naming names, if you want to, go ahead.
I invented that name for Christopher Whittle, the inventor of Channel One, which I think is one of the most offensive advertising concepts to come along in the last decade.
This is a little newscast in the schools laced with commercials, and the children apparently are innocent of the effects of the advertising and are absorbing the news.
Right, but in fact, he's selling a captive audience to advertisers. He's not interested in education. He's not interested in anything but making money.
Well, now, wait a minute. Isn't that part of what made this country what it is?
Well, if you take the point of view that this is a nation of salesmen, and some people do, uh-huh. Sometimes I'm tempted to say that it's simply a nation of salesmen and hucksters and con artists. Yeah, you could say that Christopher Whittle is in the tradition of what made America great. If you believe that the greatest thing about America is our continuing experiment in Republican self-government, mm-hmm. in the Jeffersonian tradition, you're not so crazy about seeing what Whittle's doing.
What about the links between cultural censorship, cigarette companies, and Salman Rushdie? As odd a triangle as that may seem, how do you make the connection?
Well, now I'm going to go back to some extent on what I said, and I think that advertising is protected under the First Amendment. I don't make this distinction between first commercial and political speech.
So you don't approve necessarily of the content, but you want to protect the concept.
I want to protect the concept that anybody can say anything they please, uh-huh. and that advertising is part of it, and that if you go back to the 18th century, most newspapers are just collections of advertisements anyway. That's the kind of newspaper that the founding fathers were looking at.
Yeah, Daniel Boorstin, our historian, says that's our subject.
Yeah,
that is our national discourse.
He calls advertising the language of democracy.
He's also the guy who warned us against the pseudo-event.
The pseudo-event. So I defend to the death the right of tobacco advertisers and everybody else to advertise legal products. Because, look, if you ban cigarette advertising, why couldn't you ban a political advertisement because you said it was dangerous to someone's health? Why couldn't you ban David Duke's advertising because mm-hmm. you say that's dangerous to the public's health?
Now, what does that have to do with Salman Rushdie?
Well, Salman Rushdie was and is one of my causes. After the Ayatollah pronounced his death sentence 3 years ago, I helped organize. I initiated a reading in New York by famous writers from the Satanic Verses to make the point that we weren't going to be intimidated.
Have we been? Have
yes.
we been in effect?
Yes. American publishers have been intimidated. Viking Penguin, Rushdie's publisher, was too frightened to publish the paperback, and now it's been published anonymously. And a consortium of publishers that was gonna do it is going to do it fell apart partly because they were frightened. This has not been America's finest hour in terms
but how
of defending
would you,
the
how
First
would
Amendment.
You feel? How would you feel, Rick MacArthur, defending this this enterprise the way you do? If this man were to be murdered, would you feel guilty?
If Rushdie were murdered?
Yeah.
Well, I'd be appalled because I assume he'd be murdered by the people who are trying to censor him.
Yeah, but wouldn't you in effect be saying, couldn't you say to yourself that in a way you advanced the cause of those murderers by holding this man up, flaunting him in the face of these terrorists, these fanatics, whatever you want to call them?
Well, I don't think it's going to work that way, but I have to say, Patrick Henry said, give me liberty or give me death.
So and it is a choice.
There are some things that are worth dying for, and I think the First Amendment, freedom of the speech, and freedom of speech are worth dying for.
What's your responsibility, Rick, as the publisher of arguably the thought leader magazine of the United States? I mean, here you got a small readership, but you got a very serious one and an enormous amount of influence.
Well, you're asking me...
What is your responsibility as the publisher of Harper's?
My responsibility as publisher is to protect my editor against undue influence by pressure groups, politicians, and advertisers, and to keep the magazine on a straight and narrow path, by which I mean that we cater to the interests and enthusiasms of our readers, and that's our primary responsibility.
And how do you figure that out? How do you get a concrete sense of what those readers want?
Well, I don't mean to say that we pander to the readers, because a good editor publishes what he or she is interested in first, mm-hmm. and hopes that he attracts an audience. For one thing, we're not going to publish pornography in Harper's. Although we will publish a defense of pornography in the interest of intellectual and lively debate by Sally Tisdale, uh-huh. a woman who likes pornography. I'm not going to turn Harper's into Hustler, however. Okay? That would be irresponsible, and I'm not going to do that. It would drive away all our readers and put ourselves out of business. But even if a portion of our readers object to what we're doing, that's fine. My responsibility is also to anger our readers and to enliven the debate. There's not enough debate in this country. There's not enough intellectual combat. There are not enough people speaking their convictions. I don't know much about Ross Perot, but one of the reasons people like Ross Perot is they're so relieved to hear somebody just say what he thinks, without worrying about the consequences.
Now, Mr. Lapham says that our Republican democracy is not a neat, tidy little 30-minute newscast. It is messy and complex, and we don't want that.
Precisely. Lewis wrote a brilliant two essays, actually, about the Clarence Thomas hearings. And he said, why are the New York Times and the pundits criticizing the seamy, disgusting nature of the hearing, when, in fact, this sort of thing goes on in Washington every day? It's kind of ugly, combative, vicious character assassination all the time. But for once, it was public. It was open. The whole country got to see the way Washington works.
Was it public?
Whichever side you're on in the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas affair, you've got to be glad that you got the opportunity to see the way democracy really works in Washington. And a lot of people in the press and politicians want to close that down. They don't want the American people to see the way our democracy really works, because they know that they'll be upset, appalled, whatever. Or they might decide to take action.
Rick MacArthur, I want to thank you for coming by the National Humanities Center. You're the publisher of Harper's Magazine. You write frequently for many of our national publications. Your new book is Second Front, available from Hill & Wang. Thanks for your contribution. Good luck.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Books and ideas in the electronic age. Join me now for a roundtable discussion featuring novelist Doris Betts, Shannon Ravenel, editorial director of Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and Rachel Davies, director of the Carolina Publishing Institute.
What interests me more is that New York is no longer the be-all and end-all of national publishing. Electronics have put an end to that. All of that both appalls and delights me, since the real purpose of writing is to be read and ideally to be understood, to make that communication. I don't feel electronics or new publishing is our enemy. It's just different and rather exciting.
Novelist Doris Betts,
Just as computers have affected nearly all other sectors of American culture, sophisticated electronics have also brought about important changes in publishing and the dissemination of books and ideas. But the impact of computers on contemporary culture is not simply technical. Our brave new world of electronics also calls to mind some age-old questions. How, for example, will the increasing power and versatility of computers affect the circulation of ideas between writer and reader, between publisher and audience, between mass and elite elements of our society? With questions like that on the agenda, the Carolina Publishing Institute convened for the first time last summer at the University of North Carolina. Among the conferees were novelist Doris Betts, Shannon Ravenel of Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and Rachel Davies, the director of the Carolina Publishing Institute. Our roundtable discussion begins with the comments of novelist Doris Betts, who reflects on the health and the prospects of publishing in America today.
Well, I felt as a writer somewhat, I said, like a patient who had gone to the medical association and been diagnosed and didn't feel too well. It's healthy in some ways. There are 55,000 books a year, 2,000 publishers. From a writer's point of view, it's a hard, competitive business.
Is it true that it has become, to pick up on that word that Doris uses here, Rachel, is it nothing but a business anymore? One hears horror stories about relationships between writers and publishers.
It has to be a business in the sense that if you're going to succeed, you need to know the business angles of the industry. But hopefully the craft and the business can merge successfully to have a truly good house.
Isn't that a contradiction, Doris? Writers are off by themselves, thinking their thoughts, being creative. They don't want to go out and shill these books. They don't want to go out and become marketing experts. But did I hear Rachel just say that that's, in effect, what you have to do these days?
If you want to be read, you have to. And I think most writers do want to be read.
Shannon, is this country essentially anti-intellectual? Is it essentially a country that is opposed to serious ideas? Do you look at publishing, that is to say, you stand on this, really, this tiny little island, and you publish these books, serious literary fiction, to a relatively small audience. Does that concern you?
Well, it concerns me because we need to sell as many copies of our wonderful literary fiction as we can. I think that I would certainly not like to say that America is anti-intellectual. I think that there is a hardcore readership in America who will keep buying and reading literary fiction, and I think it's very, very much smaller than the readership of easier novels.
Mm-hmm. You have a sense? Is that anything new, really?
I don't think so, no.
You've been in the business for, what did you say, 30 years?
30 years. I think that the marketing of books has changed a lot since I got into it. And when I started out in publishing, there wasn't this hard sell. I worked for a big company in Boston which published a great range of stuff from literary fiction to you know, quite popular nonfiction and how-to books. And I've seen a lot more effort put into selling the popular books. Mm-hmm. So I think we are aware of them a lot more, and that they, you know, that the country, if you go on a plane trip now and you look around to see what everyone is reading, which I always do, and they're never reading my books, they're always reading John Grisham. But there's so much marketing of those popular novels that they are read because people are aware of them. I think if we could make people aware of the wonderful, slightly more difficult or slightly more demanding fiction that is published, that there would be more readers for them. But it's expensive to get the word out. And if the book is not making money, then you can't spend money to promote it.
Rachel, how has publishing changed over the past, be arbitrary, 15, 25, 30 years? Has it evolved as drastically as these comments would indicate?
I think so. In many ways, the industry is not the one that I worked in almost 20 years ago. There are far more corporations that are getting into publishing. There are fewer small houses that are successful. The small ones that are have to look at it as a business venture. People are now looking at how you use the computer in publishing, and we had several people from Ventana Press locally in Carrboro who talked about book production and the future of book production, and it's a whole new brave world out there.
I've heard a story that the head of one of the big New York houses now says this: I'm not interested in ideas, I'm interested in product. Doris, does that ring with you? Is that the way these people talk to you about the novels you write?
I don't really think so. And we had New York editors down who are very much interested in ideas, too. On the other hand, they have to sell a certain amount of what I would call pop books in order to carry the poetry or the literary books, and I don't mind that. That's a reality. Mm-hmm. What interests me more is that New York is no longer the be-all and end-all of national publishing. Electronics have put an end to that. Your books now can be put on tape and listened to in an automobile. Mm-hmm. They can be read directly on computer. They tell me you're going to be able to walk into a bookstore and they're going to be able to pipe you in a book without the beautiful cover, but it'd be printed while you sit there and wait for 30 minutes. All of that both appalls and delights me, since the real purpose of writing is to be read and ideally to be understood, to make that communication. I don't feel electronics or new publishing is our enemy. It's just different and rather exciting.
Shannon, what's your responsibility as a publisher? Do you break it down in terms of things like the business side and the ideas side and the marketing side? How do you talk to yourself about that?
I think most publishers divide the workload up between certain individuals. In our company, the publisher is responsible for the money. Mm-hmm. The marketing director is responsible for getting those books sold, and the editorial director is responsible for producing a list of books for the sales manager to sell.
Do you fight about these things?
Yes.
I mean, what is it that what are the bones of contention? Tell me about it.
Well, the editors are so, you know, thought of as being in the ivory tower where they choose fiction that no one can understand and certainly not buy. The publisher doesn't want to spend money on those kinds of books, and the marketing director wants books that she can sell.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many books being written. Little tiny Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, who has a staff of 9, has over 2,000 manuscripts submitted a year. Those are full manuscripts. That's not counting letters of query or proposals. Of that a number of submitted manuscripts, we will publish 20.
Mm-hmm.
And of those, only less than half are by new writers.
Is there any relationship between those numbers and what we call creativity that is out there in the public? Or are we making, again, a leap there that's the logic falls apart?
Well, every publishing house is looking for a different kind of talent. So certainly the fact that Algonquin takes only 20 out of 2,000 manuscripts submitted to it means nothing in terms of how much real talent there is in the world. What I would love to happen is that English teachers in the high schools and in the colleges concentrate a little bit more on contemporary books. My daughter has been very excited by the fact that I can bring home books by people who actually live around here and that are, you know, walking around live people. And and I think when you're in high school and in college too, that one has the idea that the only good books around are the ones that are by people who are dead. Mm. So I wish we could push contemporary fiction, particularly in the schools. That would be my wish list, I guess.
Rachel?
I also think that one thing that became very clear in the Carolina Publishing Institute was that it behooves the authors to know the publishing houses or the market out there so that they can try to choose the house that's best suited for the work that they've completed. Otherwise, that can save them a lot of heartbreak.
Doris, when you wrote your new book, it's called Souls Raised from the Dead. Who was in charge here, you or the publisher? How did that work?
Well, you're in charge right up to the minute where you assign a contract, and at that point you have divided your responsibilities legally and in some sort of an obligatory way. On the other hand, the Institute made clear to me what my new contract makes clear to me, that increasingly writers are more involved with all the processes. I talked to New York yesterday, and my editor said, be thinking about the book jacket. Well, there were years when I wasn't asked about the book jacket. It was a total shock to me what they wound up putting on it. Right. I'm delighted to be asked, and I think increasingly, just as writers publicize their books, they also have more to do with how they're produced. Reynolds Price talked about this at the Institute, and again, there are many areas that can be dispersed. You no longer necessarily have your copy editor sitting in your New York house. You may farm that out. So there are lots of ways to be in publishing besides just starting your own business with the capital that requires. Rachel, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's especially true. There's an increasing number of people that are going into the industry who are freelancers, whether they're copy editors, designers, or what have you. I do think that the industry as a whole is fairly cautious as it moves towards the electronic aspect of publishing. The smaller houses can approach that and are more able to take the risk to be experimental than some of the larger ones. And so it's on the fringes that you often see the most exciting innovation.
Rachel Davies directs the Carolina Publishing Institute, a continuing education project at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Doris Betts is a novelist and professor of English. Shannon Revenel is editorial director of Algonquin Books. The second Carolina Publishing Institute is scheduled for the spring of 1994 at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. If you'd like a cassette tape of this week's program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. This week, please ask for program number 680. That's program number 680, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again, 27709. Include $2 if you'd like a complete catalog of Soundings discussions available on audio cassettes. Next week, apropos of the discussions you just heard, join me for a conversation about the first new publication in more than a century from the American writer Henry David Thoreau. My guest will be literary scholar Bradley Dean of East Carolina University. He'll be here to talk about his edition of Henry Thoreau's book, Faith in a Seed. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.